heir of my uncle. Don't worry. Lorimbas has given his word of honor that your king will leave our stronghold in the condition that he arrived.
He stared at the High King insolently.
Is your heart made of granite or pumice?
Gandergar ignored the warning looks from his adviser and jumped down from his pony.
I am the High King of the Dwarves, and my business is with Lorimbas Steelheart,
he said firmly, striding toward the guards, who raised their pikes to let him pass. The metal tips lowered, separating Belendolin and the others from the king.
My, my, said Romo, leading Gandergar into the cavernous heart of the mountain. It's astonishing how a feeble fire can produce a spark of courage. You're a typical fourthling, scrawny and small.
Brain is more important than brawn, countered Gandergar patiently. It's better to have a sharp mind than a sharp blade.
Romo turned into a side passageway, picking his way confidently through the maze of corridors and stairs. He and his kinsmen were new to the Black Saddle, but he plainly knew his way around.
A nice theory, he said, laughing. But an ogre's cudgel can blunt the sharpest wit.
On the contrary,
replied Gandergar firmly, keeping his eyes fixed on Romo's back.
Ogres are particularly easy to outsmart.
His gaze fell on a beautifully crafted scabbard, hanging from the Thirdling's belt. It looked awfully familiar. In fact, he had last seen it on the belt of a warrior who was fighting with the allies in Jon Balsur. The chances of a smith forging two such scabbards were remote.
I met him and two others in Richmark, said Romo,
when the High King inquired about its owner.
They're dead.
He shot a hostile glance at Gandergar.
You can have it if you like, but you'll have to fight me first.
Gandergar clenched his fists. It wasn't easy to keep his composure when Romo was bragging about killing three dwarfs. The Thirdling talked about murder in the way other dwarves talked of masonry or metalwork.
With pleasure, he muttered darkly, setting his jaw.
Romo hiccoughed with laughter.
What are you going to do?
He asked scornfully.
Sprinkle me with gold dust, or throw diamonds in my face?
It occurred to Gandergar that his faith in diplomacy was possibly misplaced, but he wasn't prepared to leave without trying, if only to satisfy his conscience and prove to the allies that he wasn't to blame for the feud. Without a word, he followed Romo into the great hall where the final battle against Nodon had taken place. Lorimbas Steelheart was standing in the middle of the room. His attention was focused on a recently repaired staircase that gave access to the walkways overhead. At last, he turned to greet the new arrivals.
What have I done to deserve the honor? He sneered.
Romo smiled and positioned himself at his side. Gandergar looked intently at the Thirdling monarch. His long black hair was streaked with grey and braided against his scalp in three tight plaits. Gandergar noticed that his beard had been dyed in three different colours, which was probably a mark of something, although he didn't know what. He also saw that Lorimbas, unlike the other Thirdlings, hadn't been tattooed.
I want a truce, he said simply, outlining his reasons for the visit. A cessation of hostilities until the Alfar have been defeated.
That's a new one, scoffed Lorimbas.
The hostilities haven't started, and you're asking me to stop. I didn't realize our cousins were so soft.
Don't be too harsh on him, Uncle,
chipped in Romo.
He might soil his breeches. I was referring to your efforts to turn the humans against us,
said Gandergar evenly, ignoring the snickering Romo.
Open warfare we can deal with, but your tactics are pernicious and underhanded. We know what your envoy said to Prince Malin, and we know that a dwarf was seen at King Bellatane's court.
He wasn't there on my authority, so I assume he was sent by you."
"Mellon is a short-sighted fool," Lauren Bass said breezily. "He'll soon see the error of his ways. He turned down my nephew's assistance out of misguided loyalty, but the cross of his dwarven mercenaries will come as a blow. I shouldn't wonder if he's rueing his decision already."
He let his eyes travel over the ceiling.
"It's a wonderful thing to be standing here after all this time. My forefathers lived in this stronghold until you drove them out. A new era is dawning for Gerdlegard."
He snapped out of his reverie and glowered at Gandagar.
"The decline of Beruin, Borengar, and Goimdil has begun."
He strode toward the High King, stopping only when their noses were practically touching.
"You won't weather this storm. The wind of change is blowing through the dwarven kingdoms, sweeping through the narrowest shafts and tiniest caverns. You and your subjects will be scattered, and my warriors will seize your halls."
His spiked gauntlet thumped his armored chest.
"The children of Lorimbur will stand guard at the gates of Gerdlegard, and your folks will be forgotten."
He took a step back and drew his weapon.
"I swear it on Lorimbur's axe."
"Is this how the Thirdlings negotiate?" asked Gandagar.
Lorimbas
cut him short.
"Negotiate? Who said we wanted to negotiate?"
He raised his axe.
"I have news for you, Gandagar. Your orbits in Gerdlegard are numbered, and there's nothing you can do."
Gandagar's patience, which had withstood countless indignities, suddenly snapped, allowing his pent-up fury to erupt into words. The king and his nephew had pushed him to the brink.
"Vrakus won't abandon his loyal children to the murderous wiles of Lorimba's unholy dwarfs," he shouted, clinking blades with Lorimbas. "I dare you to fight us fairly, you backstabbing coward!" "Get out!" bellowed Lorimbas, forcing Gandagar's blade to the ground. "No one threatens me in my stronghold. You're lucky I promised to let you go unharmed. I've a mind to kill you anyway."
"Can I do it for you?" asked Romo hopefully.
Lorimbas trembled with silent fury. He was fighting the urge to plant an axe in the High King's head.
"Lorimbur's children won't negotiate with the other dwarfs. Your destruction is assured."
"All right, gem cutter,"
said Romo, gripping Gandagar's shoulder.
"It's time you went home to polish your jewels."
He steered him through the door in the manner of a bailiff escorting a drunk. The High King shrugged him off angrily.
"Lay a finger on me again and you'll regret it, dwarf killer," he growled.
When Romo spat on the ground and grabbed his shoulder, he seized the Thirdling's gauntlet and swung his axe against his wrist, shattering the bone. Romo's face contorted with pain. Then he reached with his uninjured arm for his morning star, swinging back to strike. A bald-headed dwarf stepped in front of him and made a grab for his arm. The three-balled weapon thudded to the floor.
"Southalor!" he exclaimed in surprise. "What?"
"Silence, or I'll break your other wrist," the dwarf snapped.
He turned to Gandagar.
"That's the first and last time I'll save one of your kind. I want to be clear about this. Your life counts for nothing, but Romo promised not to harm you, and Lorimbas would punish him for breaking his word."
Gandagar nodded. His eyes were drawn to his rescuer's massive arms and chests. Dwarves were stocky and powerful, the Fourthlings less so than most, but even the slightest dwarf was a good deal stronger than a man. Salfalor, though, had muscles to rival the battle-crazed Boindil. Like the other Thirdlings, he was tattooed, the dark runes covering his face and his gleaming skull. Gandagar met his eye.
"At least let me thank you for..."
"I want nothing from you," growled Salfalor. "I'd sooner die in the deserts of Sangpur than drink water from your pouch.
Follow me. I'll show you out.
He strode away and Gandagar fell in behind him. Salfalor's route through the passageways of the Black Saddle took them past chambers filled with provisions, bunk rooms accommodating hundreds of dwarves, and crowded forges echoing with constant hammering. Some of the smiths were fashioning weapons. Others were working on strange pieces of metal that served no obvious purpose. Gandagar knew that no one would volunteer the information, so he saved himself the trouble of asking and studied the objects carefully, intending to describe them to the firstling's smiths. At last they reached the door leading out of the stronghold.
"Stay away from here," Salfalor advised him coldly. "If we meet again, Lorimbas will be delighted to receive your head on a plate."
He opened the door for the High King to rejoin his anxious companions. After enduring the company of the Thirdlings, Gandagar was glad to leave the stronghold and step into the sunshine, which usually hurt his eyes. He caught himself looking forward to the dreaded pony ride home.
"Well?"
asked Belendalin. Gandagar shook his head and gave a brief account of the meeting.
"I can't say I'm surprised," said Belendalin with a sigh. "They're Thirdlings, after all."
Under the steely gaze of the sentries, they turned their ponies and rode toward the south.
"Lorimbas must be very sure of himself to speak so openly of his intentions," observed Belendalin, wondering what the Thirdlings had in mind.
Lorimbas's bold predictions augured badly for the dwarfs. Judging by Gandagar's report, the Thirdlings were planning something far more serious than Bislipur's treacherous scheming. This time, the whole Thirdling kingdom was ready to mobilize against the other dwarfs. Belendalin glanced back at the sinister mountain.
"What we need is a spy."
Southern entrance to the Fifthling kingdom. Girdlegard, spring 6235th. Solar cycle. Tungdil did the first thing that came to mind. As the elf loomed over him, he dropped the axe that Boindil had given to him and reached up to block the blow. Grabbing Keenfire with both hands, he wrapped his fingers around the Sigurdaisy haft and dropped to one knee, muscles straining and joints creaking. The blade hovered above his head. Stooped over him, the elf threw all her weight behind the diamond-studded blade, arms trembling as she pushed against him. Her breath came in labored gasps. But Keenfire seemed to sense that the second set of hands belonged to Tungdil, its rightful bearer. The intarsia shimmered, and a tongue of fire licked over the axe head, reaching for the elf's mask. Moving and twisting, she stayed out of harm's way.
"You're not getting away from me again," she gasped, kicking Tungdil in the chest.
Still clutching the shaft, he tumbled backward, and the elf, determined not to lose Keenfire, came with him. She used her momentum to launch herself into the air, all the while gripping the axe. The soles of her boots sped toward him. He turned in time, rolling to the side as she landed beside him, missing his throat.
"Vrakas brought you here to give me Keenfire," he spluttered.
His right hand shot up, punching her in the belly. Uncurling his fist, he reached for her left foot, bringing her to the ground. Her black veil lifted as she fell, revealing her chin and left cheek. There was no sign of a scar or deformity that would warrant the wearing of a mask. Each had a hand on Keenfire's haft, and neither was prepared to let go. They stumbled to their feet, and Ondori, reaching behind her, drew another weapon, a scythe-like blade that Tungdil recognized from their encounter on the pier. Whipping out his dagger, he squared his shoulders and waited for a weakness in her guard. Slowly they circled each other, the thick-set dwarf at one end of the axe, the willowy elf at the other, separated by the length of the Sigurdaisy haft. The axe head was on Tungdil's side, and he could see the intarsia flickering, as if Keenfire were waiting for the opportunity to strike.
Why won't you show your face? He demanded. Only cowards hide behind a mask.
My mask shall remain in place until my murdered parents are avenged, she told him, looking at him with pure hatred.
You'll see my face before you die.
I killed your parents, did I?
You killed my mother in Greenglade, you and the warrior twins.
Tongdil twisted away as the scythe-like weapon slashed toward him.
My father you killed at the Black Saddle, she continued, slashing at him again.
This time she drew blood. She eyed his wounded throat with satisfaction.
My loss shall be avenged.
Tongdil kept his eyes on the scythe, waiting for her to strike.
I can't bring them back, but I'd be happy to help you join them, he retorted, ducking under the swooping blade and using his momentum to ram the axe head toward her.
Once again, the intarsia flared up, but the elf avoided the red-hot suspiration, only for the Circa-Daisy half to slam into her face. The mask slipped over her eyes and her veil caught alight, flames shooting through the gauze and singeing the ends of her long brown hair. Dazed by the blow and blinded by the mask, she stumbled toward him. In less time than it takes a drop of sweat to vaporize in a red-hot furnace, Tongdil was beside her, ramming his dagger through her armor. It embedded itself to the hilt. Tongdil bent down to claim Keenfire, but he was stopped by a shout from Belindis. Looking around, he saw the cause. Glaimbar was on the ground, and standing over him was a badly wounded orc. Screaming with pain, the beast raised his notched sword and prepared to smite the dwarf. Tongdil cursed roundly, wishing he could let his rival die. Instead, he picked up the axe that Boindil had given him and hurled it at the beast. Whirling end over end, the axe struck the orc beneath the armpit. Green blood gushed from the wound, spattering the sprawled Glaimbar. The orc stumbled, dropping his rusty sword. In an instant, Glaimbar was on his feet, ramming the spiked end of his axe into his enemy's neck. He slit the beast's throat and raised a hand to thank his rescuer. Tongdil, who had no intention of acknowledging his rival, looked away.
You fool, the voice inside him whispered. You should have let him die.
Tongdil gave himself a little shake.
Where was I?
He said, turning back to finish off the elf. But she and Keenfire were gone. A trail of blood led into the heart of the battle, losing itself among the mass of dwarves and orcs. The masked elf had escaped to live another orbit, and Keenfire was in her hands.
I'll never find her now.
Tongdil remembered what she had said about her parents. Synthorus was her father, he thought. He picked up an abandoned axe and threw himself on the remaining orcs, drawing strength from his frustration at losing Keenfire for a second time. Hoping against hope that he would find the elf, he cleaved through the beasts. But the axe and the elf had disappeared. It was late afternoon when the battle ended. The dwarfs had won a decisive victory, but the mood was subdued. They gathered the headless bodies of their enemies and threw them into the basin, where they floated among hundreds of spluttering orcs. After killing the survivors by pelting their heads with rocks, the dwarves decided to drain the basin and let the sun do its work. Later, the bleached bones would be strewn around the stone gateway as a warning to invading beasts. Tongdil stood on the plateau and scanned the mountainside below. It seemed to him that a small dot was moving rapidly across the horizon toward the southeast. He felt sure it was the elf, in which case it was futile to think of chasing her by pony, let alone on foot.
It's Glaimbar's fault, he told himself, kicking the ground angrily.
A stone skittered down the mountainside.
I had the elf where I wanted her. Keenfire was mine.
I wanted to thank you properly, Tongdil Goldhand, said the object of his curses. Any dwarf would intervene to save his king, he replied.
Too frustrated to hide his hostility, he kept his back turned.
"I forfeited Keenfire," he said pointedly.
"I know," said Glaimbar, sighing.
He stood next to Tungdil.
"I suppose it isn't possible to forge a replacement. Boindil seems to think we can."
"Keenfire is irreplaceable," said Tungdil, happy to twist the knife a little further. "We could forge a new blade, but the haft was fashioned from the last remaining fragments of Sycadaisy wood in Girdlegard." He turned to face the king.
"I don't fancy fighting the threat from the west without our strongest weapon. If the Alfar join forces with the new invaders, Keenfire could be used against us. Who knows how we'll fare?"
"Vrakas will give us the strength to prevail," said Belindis, positioning herself at Glaimbar's side. She looked at Tungdil reprovingly.
"Besides, you won't be fighting alone," chimed in Mir, overhearing the conversation. "You'll have our warriors as well."
She finished tending to a wounded dwarf and took her place next to Tungdil. The battle lines were drawn. To Tungdil's satisfaction, Belindis looked put out.
"It's time we properly met," said Mir. "I'm Mir Meander Alabaster from the Freeling folk. Tungdil battled his way to our realm to remind us that we dwarves were hewn from the same rock."
She shook hands with Belindis and Glaimbar.
"I'm here at the request of King Gemmel, who raised the army of 2,000 warriors that helped you today."
Glaimbar bowed.
"Tell King Gemmel that he saved our kingdom from the orcs. It was only a matter of time before they launched their next assault. We owe our lives to your king."
Tungdil surveyed the dwarfs who had come from all corners of Girdlegard to defend the northern pass. The comrades in arms were working together to gather their dead. 400 warriors from the Fifthling Kingdom had fallen in battle. Their bodies would be laid in the Great Hall for the Fifthlings to pay their respects. After an orbit, the fallen warriors would be placed in the burial vaults. The Freelings had suffered heavy losses as well, and barely 1,000 of Gemmel's warriors had survived. The others would rest in peace beside their Fifthling comrades.
"How many are planning to stay?" asked Tungdil.
"You'd better ask her," said Mir, pointing to an armor-clad warrior almost twice her size. "Sander Flameheart is Gemmel's wife." She called her over.
As Sander approached, the others noticed the dark lines and menacing runes on her face. Her whole visage was covered in intricate tattoos, the like of which Tungdil, Belindis, and Glaimbar had never seen. The symbols spelled out terrible threats against the other dwarven folks. Glaimbar's fingers tightened around his axe.
"There's nothing to worry about," Mir hastened to reassure him. "Sander was born a Thirdling, but she served our army for over 2 cycles. She's a popular queen and a respected commander, and she's certainly not a dwarf hater, in spite of her tattoos."
She greeted Sander with a hug.
"Thank goodness you got here when you did. We weren't expecting you so soon."
"We came through the underground network. Some of the tunnels were damaged, but Vrakas kept us safe," she laughed. "Gemmel couldn't wait to get rid of us. He was convinced we'd be late."
"He was right to worry," said Glaimbar, trying not to stare at her tattoos.
"We owe our victory to you."
His eyes were riveted on her face. Sander smiled broadly, answering his unspoken doubts with a warmth and friendliness at odds with the sinister runes.
"I know what you're thinking, King Glaimbar. It's no wonder you're confused. Here I am, talking to you as an ally, with the promise of your destruction etched across my face."
She held out her hand.
"I'm a Thirdling on the outside, but at heart, I'm a child of the smith. I wasn't born to hate."
Glaimbar hesitated briefly before taking her outstretched hand.
"Lineage isn't everything," he said firmly, as if to convince himself. "Tungdil Golhand has shown us that." "Tungdil and I aren't the only Thirdlings who weren't born to hate the other dwarves. My story is long in the telling, but later, when we've raised our tankards to slain enemies and lost friends,
I'll tell you how I came to leave the kingdom of my birth.
Sander, this is the hero of the Black Saddle, said Mir. She cast a sideways glance at Belindis. Tungdil is a dear friend of mine already.
Belindis bristled visibly, as Mir had hoped she would.
We were wondering how long you were planning to stay, continued Mir. King Glaimbar and the future queen, Belindis, have invited the Freelings to join their folk.
Sander laid a powerful hand on her weapons belt.
We'll stay until the danger has passed.
She turned to Glaimbar.
Too many dwarfs were killed in the battle. You could do with reinforcements at the gateway, I imagine.
She smiled as he nodded.
As for moving to the Fifthling Kingdom, none of my warriors intend to stay at present. But they're free to change their minds. Who knows? Maybe the Fifthling Kingdom will gain 1,000 extra axes.
She looked at him levelly.
Naturally, anyone who chooses to join the Fifthlings will submit to your command. As regards the rest of us, we'd like to be treated as guests.
Tungdil could tell that she meant what she said. The Freelings were happy to help, but they wanted their independence.
Could you spare a moment later?
He asked Sander.
I was hoping you might know something about my parents.
With pleasure, she promised.
Now, if you'll excuse me, I need to attend to my troops.
She hurried away, the others watching in silence.
I can't pretend that it's easy for me to trust her, admitted Glaimbar.
He turned to Mir.
When did you say she arrived in your realm?
2 cycles ago. I don't blame you for being wary. But Sander is an upstanding dwarf.
She shifted her weight, nudging closer to Tungdil and allowing their arms to touch. Tungdil pretended not to notice and stood his ground, willing Belindis to see that he too had forged a bond with another dwarf.
Those who seek to become Freelings must submit to certain tests, continued Mir. Sander passed with flying colors, and she's proven her worth on countless occasions.
She's obviously popular with your king, observed Belindis. It seems to me that Glaimbar is right to be suspicious. If I were a Thirdling spy, I'd make friends with my enemies before I betrayed them.
Mir's face hardened.
Don't let Sander hear you talking like that, or she'll challenge you to a duel. Warriors are very particular about their honor. Besides, she's my friend.
Her red eyes bored into Belindis like daggers.
From now on, it was war. I hope Vrakas helps me to conquer my doubts, said Glaimbar, sighing. I dare say we are honored to have the Freelings as our guests.
He decided to steer the conversation to safer ground.
Tell me, Tungdil, is Jerun here for a reason?
Tungdil reached for the leather cylinder hanging from his shoulder and pulled out a scroll. Andukai's bodyguard had waited until the end of the battle to hand him a letter. Since then, he had been standing patiently by the waterfall, his armor gleaming majestically in the setting sun. Tungdil unfurled the roll of parchment and began to read aloud.
Dearest Tungdil, the purpose of this letter is to secure the services of the finest smith in Girdlegard. Jerun requires a new suit of armor and a tunic of chainmail. Enclosed are his measurements and the composition of the alloy for the attention of Belindis Steelfinger. When she comes to fitting the armor, Belindis must bind her eyes and gauge the fit with her fingers. Make her promise to remain blindfolded until Jerun is fully clad in his armor. This I ask for her own safety. No one must look on Jerun's face. As for the cost, tell her to name a sum and I will pay. Jerun will be heading west across the Red Range. His instructions are to assess the situation in the outer lands and determine the nature of the threat. If the danger is real and not a figment of Nadon's imagination, we need to know what to expect. By the time you receive this letter, Narmora and I will be in Weyern, where we hope to find record of migrants from the outer lands. Perhaps they will tell us something about their homeland. Vrakas be with you, Andukai.
Tungdil lowered the letter
and handed Belindis the notes regarding the giant's measurements and the composition of the alloy.
"It's lucky that Jeroen turned up when he did," he observed. "He couldn't have arrived at a better time. Thank goodness Andukai worships Samusin. Her bodyguard restored the equilibrium."
The smith scanned the list of metals and glanced at the giant.
"How will he know what I'm saying?
I can't speak his tongue."
"Andukai will have thought of that," replied Tungdil.
Belindis turned to leave, but he laid a hand on her shoulder.
"Hang on," he said, pulling her back. "I need you to promise not to look at Jeroen's face."
"I wouldn't look at his face for all the gold in Girdlegard," she retorted sharply, shaking him off. Tungdil watched as she hurried away, followed by Glaimbar. They exchanged a few words before Glaimbar took charge of the clean-up operation and Belindis attended to Jeroen. Tungdil gazed at her sadly. He wanted to call out and apologize for his childish behavior. He was already sorry for his rudeness. For some reason, he couldn't keep a check on his thoughts and emotions when Belindis was around. If he was honest with himself, he still loved her, in spite of his growing feelings for Mir.
"Do I really like Mir? Or am I just trying to punish Belindis for choosing Glaimbar?"
Sometimes he wished that he were back in Lot Ionan's school. Life had been simpler then. Mir seemed to guess what he was thinking. She slipped her hand into his.
"Isn't it time we went to see your friend?" she asked.
"I'd like to help him if I can." Tungdil was too wrapped up in his thoughts to realize whom she meant, but then it dawned on him.
"Come on," he said, squeezing her hand impulsively. "Let's see what you can do for Boendal."
They hurried through the passageways of the Fifthling Kingdom and arrived in the forge. Boendil was sitting on a stool beside the dragonfire furnace, regaling his frozen brother with stories about the battle against the orcs. Every now and then, he thumped a battered helmet that he had stolen from an enemy head.
"But it wasn't the same without you. Nothing's the same without you,"
he finished sadly, noticing Tungdil and Mir.
Boindil had been trying to stay cheerful for the sake of his twin, but found it impossible to hide his feelings from the others. The truth was, it smote his soul to see Boendal in a death-like sleep. He stood up and smoothed his black beard. What he was about to say didn't come easily to a warrior.
"Mir," he began, "I saw you tending to the wounded on the battlefield, and I saw you cure Tungdil. You're the best doctor I've ever known."
He swallowed.
"I'm begging you, bring Boendal back to life. Cure my brother, and I'll protect you with my life. Nothing and no one will ever hurt you."
He made room for her at Boendil's bedside.
"I'd be honored to help," Mir said simply. "You don't need to promise anything in return."
Perching on the secondling's bed, she laid a hand on his forehead, then lifted his eyelids to look at his pupils.
"I can't examine him properly in his clothes," she told the others. "Let's get everything off except his apron. I need to see if the blood is still flowing to his limbs."
Tungdil and Boendil stripped the sleeping dwarf. The next hour passed in silence as Mir examined every inch of her patient's body. Nothing escaped her scrutiny.
"Your brother was blessed by Vrakus," she pronounced.
"His limbs are cold but not frozen, and his skin looks healthy enough."
"So he's basically all right?" said Boindil eagerly.
"I was worried he might have frostbite."
She lowered her head to listen to Boindil's heart and breathing.
"It tends to affect the toes and the fingers. The digit freezes, blackens, and eventually falls off. Sometimes the patient is too numb to realize what's happening. It's a nasty condition and impossible to treat."
She listened intently.
"Extraordinary.
His heart is beating, his lungs are working, but his body has slowed right down. His inner furnace must be burning very low."
A smile spread over her face. "That's it. Fetch me a tub of warm water and some beeswax."
Warm water? Queried Boindil doubtfully. We tried that before. It didn't work.
Patience, she said mysteriously.
The tub was brought in. Mir produced a strip of leather, rolled it up to make a tube, and secured it with some cord. She placed an end between Boindil's blue lips and sealed his mouth and nose with the warm wax, forcing him to breathe through the tube.
Right, she declared purposefully. Let's get him into the water.
Soon the dwarf was submerged in the tub, his arms and legs weighed down with lead.
This will thaw him out and melt the ice in his brain, she explained. Fetching a shovel load of glowing coals from Dragonfire. The hot coals hissed as they splashed into the water, warming the bath. Mir was careful not to let them fall on Boindil.
Tungdil checked the temperature with his hand.
It's pretty hot already.
Boindil leaned over, frowning anxiously.
You'll boil him like a sausage if you're not careful.
He glared at Mir as she stepped forward to empty another load of coals into the tub.
Put them back, Mir. You'll stew him alive.
I thought you wanted me to cure him, she retorted.
Hot water won't hurt him.
He has to be immersed completely or his brain will clog with ice. I know what I'm doing, Boindil.
She raised the shovel to tip out the coals, but Boindil made a grab for the handle, forcing her to stop.
I said enough, he growled,
squaring his shoulders to prove he meant business.
I won't stand by while you turn my brother into broth. You'll have to think of another cure.
Her red eyes stared back at him fearlessly.
I'm the expert on this, Boindil Doubleblade.
She tried to wrench the shovel away from him. He hadn't reckoned with her resistance and pulled back too sharply. A large piece of coal separated itself from its white-hot neighbors, slid to the edge of the shovel, and launched itself into the tub. Steam rose as it sank through the water. Tungdil, determined to save his friend from harm, plunged his hand into the tub and tried to catch the glowing coal. His fingers swept the water in vain. The fiery missile plummeted toward Boindil's bare chest and struck the skin on a level with his heart. Tungdil watched as the dwarf's body twitched.
Did you see that? He asked the others. Boindil just...
At that moment, the sleeping twin opened his eyes, sat up with a jolt, and tore the tube from his mouth. After a few gasps of air, he started coughing.
Lift him out, said Mir, holding up some warm towels to swaddle the dripping dwarf.
Boindil wiped his brother's face gently and waited for the coughing fit to pass.
You're awake,
he said excitedly, throwing his arms around him. Boindil tried to say something, but his voice was just a croak. He had to clear his throat a few times, and even then he could speak only in a feeble whisper.
What happened?
Thrilled by his friend's recovery, Tungdil was about to launch into an account of everything that had happened since the avalanche, but Mir stopped him.
All in good time, she said firmly. Boindil, we need to find you something to wear. Then you should try to eat and drink a little. Your stomach needs to get accustomed to food again. No meat, no beer.
Her tone was so emphatic that no one, not even Boindil, dared to object.
Give yourself time to adjust. You're going to be just fine.
She smiled at him warmly. Boindil looked at her in bewilderment.
Who are you? Mir melted your inner cold, explained his brother.
He clasped the freeling to his chest, overcome with gratitude.
Forgive me for doubting you. I promised to protect you if you healed him, and I will. Vrakas can smite me with his hammer if ever I forget my debt.
She laughed to see his bearded face light up with boyish excitement.
I forgive you, she said happily.
Tungdil made no mention of what he had observed. In his opinion, it was the falling coal, not Mir's bath, that had awoken Boindil. Still, an apology was in order, and Mir might be glad of extra protection. He turned back to the bed.
"How are you feeling, Boendal?" he asked.
Speaking seemed to cost the twin a great deal of effort.
"My fingers are still numb," he said ponderously. "I can feel them tingling. Thank Fracas, the White Death didn't take me."
Mir reached for his left hand and massaged the fingers carefully. "Does that feel better?" Boendal nodded.
"Good," she said relieved. "The blood is coming back, so you won't lose your fingers. You should start to perk up this evening, and by tomorrow you'll be fighting fit. Just be sure to keep warm."
She smiled at him.
"Great things lie ahead for you, Boendal Hookhand. Fracas went to a lot of trouble to keep you alive."
She dried her hands on the corner of his towels and yawned.
"I hope you don't mind if I excuse myself. I'm ready to drop."
Boendal took her hand.
"Thank you," he whispered gratefully. "Whoever you are, wherever you come from, thank you for saving my life. From now on, your enemies will be my enemies. I'm forever in your debt."
"My name is Mir Meander Alabaster. It's kind of you to thank me. But I don't need a reward. It's enough to see you awake." She stroked his hand gently.
"You're warming up nicely."
She made sure that he was wrapped in the towels and stayed at his bedside until the clothes and food arrived. Once dressed, Boendal wolfed down the meal while Boendil sat beside him and started to recount their adventures, beginning with the forging of Keenfire and the journey to the Black Saddle.
"Come on," said Tungdil to Mir. "Let's find you somewhere to sleep."
They took their leave of the twins and hurried out of the forge. "There's usually plenty of space in the halls, but what with the wounded and the other freelings, still we're bound to find somewhere."
"Tungdil, I'm dead on my feet. Can't I sleep in your chamber? I won't be a nuisance, I promise. The floor will do just fine."
"Nonsense," said Tungdil. "You can have my bed while I keep looking. Are you sure you don't want something to eat?"
She shook her head. It was only a short walk through the passageways to Tungdil's chamber. He opened the door and ushered her in, then stepped back outside.
"Can you give me a hand?" asked Mir,
tugging tiredly on her chainmail.
"I can barely lift my arms."
"Of course," he said with a smile. "You know what the problem is. You need more muscles."
He walked in and showed her to the bed.
"It's not too soft, which means it's perfect for us dwarves."
It occurred to him that softer beds might be customary in the Freelings' realm.
"You can pad it out with blankets, if you like."
"No,"
she said, suppressing a yawn. She lifted her arms over her head.
"I'd fall asleep on a bed of nails right now. Do you think you could..."
He took hold of the bottom of her tunic and pulled it carefully over her head. Underneath, she was wearing a padded jerkin with a V-shaped neckline that revealed her plump white breasts. Embarrassed, he draped the tunic on the rack designed to take his mail.
"Sleep well, Mir."
"Mmm, that feels good," she said, reaching up and stretching luxuriously.
She kicked off her boots and slipped into bed.
"I'm going to sleep like a rock."
She smiled at him.
"Thank you for letting me have your bed."
Her red eyes shifted to something behind him. Tungdil glanced at the half-open door in time to see a shadow speed down the corridor.
"I'll be dreaming of you,"
whispered Mir, brushing her lips against his cheek and closing her eyes. The kiss had a paralyzing effect on Tungdil's mind. At once he forgot everything, including his intention to speak to Sander Flameheart. Belindis was hammering furiously. Sparks flew in all directions, showering the furthest corners of the forge, while the dragonfire furnace continued to exude an incredible heat. Sweat was streaming from her body.
even though she wore nothing but a thin linen shirt and lightweight leather breeches beneath her smith's apron. Her head was covered with a scarf to protect her hair from sparks. The hammer rose and fell until the troublesome metal cracked. Cursing, she picked it up with her tongs and tossed it into a cart, where it landed on top of her previous four efforts. Later, the metal would be melted down to make weapons and tools. She waited until the jangling echo had faded from the forge. "I may as well give up," she thought despondently, leaning against the anvil. She dipped a wooden ladle into the bucket of water beside her and took a sip. "I can't afford to be angry. It's making me careless." She was furious with Tungdil on two counts. First, for refusing to see her point of view, and second, for carrying on with Mir. To top things off, Mir seemed very comfortable in the role of his girlfriend, too comfortable. And Tungdil's ploy was working. She was jealous. "Why can't he see that I love him?" Clan Lore had forced her to betroth herself to Glaimbar, but her heart still longed for Tungdil, even though she knew her fiancé to be a worthy dwarf. She had spent a good deal of time with Glaimbar, who genuinely adored her. He knew of her feelings for Tungdil, but he wanted to love her and treat her well. Belindis took another sip of water. "I mustn't be too hard on him. He doesn't understand our traditions." Tungdil's upbringing in Lot Ionan's school was the root of the problem. He was a dwarf at heart, but when it came to love, he behaved like a man. It didn't help that his pride was hurt as well. "Maybe one orbit he'll understand that I couldn't defy the will of my family and my clan." She got up and looked for something to distract her thoughts. "Fracas knows it wasn't easy for me." She took out Andakai's letter and left the forge for the smelting works. Fires blazing, the blast furnaces were spewing out iron, steel and bronze, from which the smiths fashioned tools, armor and replacement parts for all manner of things. The new Fithling kingdom was taking shape. Belindis chose one of the smaller furnaces that was designed for smaller quantities of metal. She went in search of the elements for the armor, as listed in Andakai's letter, and loaded them into carts. Together the metals would form the basis of Jerun's plate mail, just as the Maegar had prescribed. Astonishingly, Belindis, who was a master smith, had never heard of the compound. "Drat!" She held the sheet of parchment in the air. Her sweat had drenched the paper, and the ink had run in places, making it difficult to decipher the Maegar's flowing script. "Is that Tionium or Palandium?" It took a great deal of effort to make sense of the instructions, and she privately doubted that the formula would work. It sounded too unlikely. If she had understood correctly, she was supposed to add small quantities of tin, copper, and mercury to the steel, followed by an equal quantity of racassium and Tionium or Palandium. Or Tionium and Palandium. The metals had similar properties, but Tionium was black in color and belonged to the Dark Lord Tion, whereas Palandium was silvery white and four times cheaper. The goddess Palandiel was worshipped in the human kingdoms, so her metal was popular with Girdlegard smiths. "I don't know what to do. The formula is too vague." She ascended the steps leading to the hatch at the top of the furnace. The flames were burning fierce and white, fueled by coals from the dragonfire furnace. The tin and other metals had been added already. "I can't ask Andakai," Belindis thought glumly, weighing the Tionium in one hand and the Palandium in the other. She hesitated for a moment and read the formula again, but she was still none the wiser. By now the other metals were beginning to coalesce. She had to act fast. Pulling on thick leather gloves to protect her hands from the rising heat, she dropped the black metal carefully through the hatch and followed it with the Palandium. "Andakai worships the god of equilibrium.
Samusin will balance everything out. She turned a winch to lower the lid over the hatch and keep in the heat. Back on ground level, she worked the enormous bellows and pumped air into the furnace, fanning the flames. Every now and then she opened a hatch and tossed in some white-hot coals from Dragonfire until the furnace had reached the requisite temperature. She retreated to a safe distance of 4 paces. A chimney channeled the foul-smelling gases away from the underground halls, drawing them through a duct in the ceiling to the surface. Belindis waited until she was sure that the metals had combined. Then, taking a long stick, she broke the clay seal at the base of the furnace. Golden and gleaming, the liquid alloy streamed forth. Belindis skimmed the slag from the top as it flowed through a clay conduit on its way to a cart lined with fire bricks. Surrounded by the heat of the furnace, she felt completely at home. Beads of sweat formed on her skin, evaporating almost instantly. She watched in anticipation as the alloy cooled and dulled. Picking up a pair of tongs, she took hold of the red-hot hook on the end of the cart and pulled the precious load along the rail that led from the smelting works to the forge. "Right," she said to herself. "Let's see what happens when Samusin entrusts a formula to a dwarf."
Windchime Island, Kingdom of Wayern, Girdlegard, late spring, 6235th solar cycle. Towering waves crashed toward the shore, dashing themselves to pieces on the rocks. A tiny host of droplets rose high above the roiling lake and lingered, almost suspended on an instant, before dropping into the waves below and disappearing without trace. The air glistened moistly above the cliff, shrouding an ancient temple built in honor of Palandiel. Inside the building, Narmora gathered the shawl about her shoulders and shivered. Even the thick walls of the former temple did little to muffle the constant pounding of waves against the shore. The change of season had brought storms to Windchime Island, with spring doing battle with summer, and winter seizing the chance to sidle in.
"What possessed you to store your books here?" Andakai asked the chief archivist, a balding man of some 60 cycles. His costly robes looked shabby and ill-fitting, and his nose was permanently red, owing to a fondness for drink. The Maegar eyed him reprovingly.
"It's too damp for a library."
"I'm afraid the timing of your visit is most unfortunate. The damp spell will be over in a couple of orbits. Windchime is known throughout Wayern for its temperate weather."
Bowing respectfully, he led the women through the stacks to a cabinet measuring 7 paces high and crammed with books.
"The official records from the last 100 cycles, he said with a flourish. "Births, marriages, and deaths."
Do you keep separate records for migrants?" asked Namora, hoping to limit the scope of the search. She had no desire to spend longer than necessary on the island, to which she had taken an instant dislike. Besides, she was worried that Dorsa, a delicate child by nature, would catch a chill.
"We're looking for settlers from the outer lands," she explained.
The archivist thought for a moment.
"With a bit of luck and Palandiel's blessing, you'll find what you're looking for in the south wing."
He wiped his nose on his sleeve.
"These records deal only with Her Majesty's subjects. Outsiders, including migrants from the rest of Girdlegard, are listed in the other wing."
He set off down the corridor to show them the way. Narmora lagged a few paces behind, watching as Andakai, brandishing a decree from Queen Wei, attempted to commandeer the library staff and anyone else with the power of reading to help with her quest. In word and deed, Narmora was a model for Mula, hard-working and loyal. Since the accident, she had applied herself more diligently than ever to her studies, delighting the Maegar with her progress. But Namora's motivation for learning magic had changed. The threat from the west and the future of Girdlegard was secondary concerns. After the whispered conversation with Rodario that night in Perista, Narmora had returned to Fergus's bedside and sworn an oath of revenge that required her to bide her time and study patiently while disguising the rancor and fury that filled her thoughts. The little party reached the south wing of the library. Andukai turned to her Fimula and pointed to the stacks on the right. A wooden stepladder led up to additional shelves behind a balustrade.
You start on this side, and I'll work toward you. The others can take the lower shelves.
Narmora nodded and ascended the creaking steps to the narrow gangway. A low rail protected careless readers from tumbling 10 paces to the floor. Andukai waved to her from the other side and pulled out a folio. Dust scattered everywhere as she turned the first page. Narmora reached for a volume as well and began to read, her eyes roving over the spidery handwriting without attending to the meaning.
How could you go to such lengths to bend me to your will?
She leafed through the volume, seeing nothing but the Maegar's betrayal on every page. The story recounted to her by the ashen-faced Rodario pointed to a single, terrible explanation. Andokai had orchestrated the attack on Fergus as a means of recruiting Narmora as her Fimula. The Maegar's strange behavior, the deaths of the highwaymen, Jerun's determination to silence Nodon's former Fimula, it all added up. She turned the page absent-mindedly.
You'll be sorry for teaching me your art, she thought grimly, glancing at Andukai.
She was prepared to bide her time until Fergus was cured and the threat from the west discounted or defeated. But sooner or later, the Maegar would pay for her treachery, and Jerun himself would be powerless to help her. Narmora felt nothing but loathing for the woman who had put her husband in a coma and killed her baby son. Anger simmered inside her, and she turned her mind to other thoughts, afraid that her Alvish heritage would betray her hidden rage.
"I think I've found something," called Andukai suddenly.
Her dutiful Fimula hurried over.
70 cycles ago, a group of travelers arrived in Gastinga, the Maegar continued. It says here that they came from the outer lands. Their children or grandchildren should still be alive.
She summoned the archivist and inquired about the location of the place.
It's here on the island, he said. It takes 2 orbits to get there. I'll loan you one of my assistants to show you the way.
Splendid, exclaimed Andukai, satisfied.
Samusin has rewarded us for the long and wearisome journey from Perista.
The man cleared his throat.
Perhaps the estimable Maegar could refrain from invoking foreign gods in the library. It's a consecrated building.
Andukai turned her head slowly and jutted out her angular chin.
I'll speak the name of my god whenever and wherever I please. Samusin saved me from Nodon and lent me his power in the fight against the Perish Land. My fellow Magi, devotees of the gentle Palandiel, didn't fare so well. It seems to me that my foreign god is more deserving of your respect.
She gestured to the shelves.
And don't lecture me about desecrating your temple. Palandiel left here when you filled her house with books.
She started down the ladder.
I want to ride within the hour. Tell your man to be ready.
Her boots clacked harshly against the tiled floor. Narmora raised her eyebrows and smiled sympathetically at the archivist, before following the Maegar out of the room.
I'm going to check on Dorsa, she told her mentor. Who knows, I might be in time to stop Rasild unpacking our trunks.
Without waiting for the Maegar's approval, she hurried through the corridors of the vaulted building, once home to Palandiel's priests, before the temple was converted to a library and a new place of worship built in honor of the goddess. She found her daughter in the arms of Rasild, the nursemaid employed by Andukai for the duration of the trip. Rasild was still young, and her breasts were plump with milk. It was a mystery to Namora why the maid had agreed to leave her own small child and her family to accompany them on their journey, unless she was forced.
"She's a thirsty wee thing," said Rosild.